Good morning, Professor Backoff. Thank you for joining us today on Forthright Radio.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me, Joy.
Let's begin by asking a very basic question. What is cognitive ethology?
The basic answer to your basic question is that cognitive ethology is a study of animal minds. And then, you know, you can expand it, but really it's the study of animal cognition, animal emotions, the moral lives of animals. So it's basically whatever's happening in their heads, if you will. And, you know, a lot of people are really interested in what's happening in the hearts of other animals. So I like to think of it as sort of a combination of heads and hearts and what they're feeling, what they're thinking, what they know, for example.
Now, you make a point of stating the obvious that humans are animals. There are some who, for primarily religious reasons, don't want to own up to that. But for purposes of our discussion today, humans are animals, they're mammals, and we will just take that as a given. In your books, you have explained the scientific basis for believing that all animals, and when we say animals, we're going to refer to them as distinct from humans from this point on, just for shorthand.
Oh, sure.
Animals, in fact, do have emotions. Would you elaborate on that and explain what some of the science is behind that?
There's a lot. There's basic ethology, and this is, if you will, where cognitive ethology fits in. But looking at what animals do in certain situations, such as when they're happy and they're playing, or they're grieving because they've lost a family member or a friend, when they show fear, when they show ambivalence. So the behavioral data that you collect from watching the animals is very valuable, as is our data from, say, neurobiological studies. There's some really good work being done on neuroimaging now, doing MRIs in animals and looking at what parts of the brain fire when animals are experiencing certain emotions. So I think it's a combination, you know, and the neuro work is non-invasive. I'm against invasive research, and it's kind of silly to do invasive research when you are working with sentient beings who you know joy and also grief and pain and suffering. I'm heartened by some of the work done using functional magnetic resonance imaging, fMRI.
Let's get even more basic, and I should have preceded that question with this one. What are emotions, and what are their purposes? Because you study evolutionary biology.
It depends on how you want to define them. I feel very comfortable, sort of, you could say that emotions are psychological states, if you will. They reflect states of the brain, states of hormones in circulating in your body. But I think about emotions as feelings. You know, what are you feeling in a certain situation when you're playing, when you're grieving, when you're embarrassed, when you're jealous, for example. And I find that to be really the good guide. And to me, the question about the evolution of emotions, and I think you're getting here, is why have they evolved, not if they have evolved. We've evolved in our views of animals and animal emotions over the last decade or so, because there's very few people who are going to sit back and tell you that, well, we're not sure whether non-human animals feel emotions. Then we can fill in the details with a lot of studies, if you will. So you could look at emotions as regulating behavior, motivating certain behaviors. I like to think of emotions as social glue, and that's what I call them, because you can use emotions to bring animals together. You can share emotions. We know that a lot of animals display empathy now, including chickens, for example. So you can have shared emotions in a group that could help to coordinate the group, bring animals together when they're needed for, you know, say social support or support for getting food or defending territory. So I like to simply think of emotions as social glue, and that they regulate and they can maintain and regulate, control certain behavior patterns. You can't ask them what they're feeling, but once again, you can use behavior And same sorts of data have been collected looking at empathy in mice, where mice who are in pain receive care from other mice, and there's evidence that mice and rats can read the facial expressions of other mice and rats. And a lot of people think, oh, well, that is just simply amazing. Well, I think it's amazing, but it's not surprising, because if you're a mouse or a rat, you need to be able to know what other mice or rats are feeling.
That brings us to how I initially heard of you and your work. I was sent a forward of an email you sent about the USDA's secret war on wildlife exposed, USDA's secret war on wildlife, and the Profanity Peak pack set up and sold out. And the work that you have done on emotions and the social makeup of packs, for example, seems to me to be crucial to our understandings of wolf behavior, for example. I would love it if you would please speak to that. And I also want us to get into the USDA secret war on wildlife. But first, please talk about the nature and structure of wolf society.
Well, wolves live in groups called packs, males, females, young of the year, you know, animals of different ages. They function in a coordinated way for getting food, defending food and territory, raising young. It's called cooperative breeding. They share one another's emotions, I'm sure. They can read one another very, very well. And they form really and maintain long-term close social bonds. So when an individual is lost, it can change the integrity of the pack, the cohesion among members, and in some cases, in wolves and other group or pack living animals, the loss of an individual or individuals leads to the dissolution of the group. That's sort of the Cliff Notes version, but it's a real version, of course, in terms of wolf society. The war on wildlife, it's continuing today. You know, you mentioned the Profanity Peak pack, six of whose members were killed last year. And this year, there's been some killings in Washington as well, the Smackout pack. And so what's really frustrating about the whole thing is it's a messy situation. You've got wolves living as wild animals. You've got cows grazing on public land. You've got a situation where cows are placed where there are wolves. I kind of liken it to getting room service in a hotel. You know, someone delivers you your meal right to the door. So there's a lot of concern and a lot of controversy and conflict over the grazing of animals on public land. There's another matter. There's a group called the Wolf Advisory Group, the WAG, in the state of Washington, and some welfare societies and conservation societies, like organizations like Defenders of Wildlife, belong to that group. And to the best of my knowledge, and literally as of, you know, 5 minutes ago, because I've been really deeply involved in this, none of them has come out and said no to the killing. I understand that some individuals who work for these groups, and I've heard that, you know, the groups per se are against the killing and regret the killing, but we still are at a standstill in terms of, say, Defenders of Wildlife coming out and saying clearly no to the killing. And I've also heard, and I think it's true, that on the Wolf Advisory Group in Washington, there's no dissenting. I mean, you know, somebody told me that you're on the group and that's it. And so it's really disturbing to me. And I mean, I'm not alone. In fact, 5 minutes ago, literally right before you called, I got yet another email from somebody who's decided to pull their support from Defenders of Wildlife. And frankly, I think it's about time that these groups come clean and they simply say, we are against the killing and we will not support the killing. And in this essay I wrote, it's sort of equivalent to saying, not saying no is really tantamount to saying yes.
I had the impression from the video, the profanity Pete Pack set up and sold out, that the four members of the Washington Wolf Advisory Group you were mentioning, Wolf Haven International, the Humane Society of the U.S., Defenders of Wildlife and Conservation Northwest actually agreed to the extermination of the pack. I haven't verified that allegation, but it's certainly stated in that video put out by Predator Defense. And I will have a link after this interview on the website to Predator Defense so listeners can see this for themselves. Do you have information that they did not agree, they simply didn't disagree?
Well, that's where it gets a bit tricky. And yes, that's my take, is that they're members of the group and they're complicit in the killing of these animals. I mean, really, over the last couple of weeks, based on an essay I wrote, which included an interview with Brooks Fahey, who made that film, and he's the head of Predator Defense, that these four groups are on the advisory group, and the killing went on. I mean, and, you know, as I've pointed out in my essay and elsewhere, some people said, well, we're against the killing, but the killing is going to happen, and we're going to kill six wolves, say the profanity peak pack last year, to save wolves in the future. But now two wolves and of the Smackout pack have been killed, and, of course, they're going after them. So my take, and I really feel very strongly about this, Joy, is that these groups should just publicly come out and say they're against the killing. I think what is kind of interesting here is that they're not doing it, and so what else could you, you know, conclude? I mean, it would be very easy for them to just put out a public announcement and say that we are against the killing, and, you know, you could also say we don't want to be part of this wolf advisory group, which is supporting the killing, and, you know, they sanitize it because they call it the, quote, authorized removal of the wolves. And so I honestly think there's a problem there, and that's my take on it. And I know individuals have written to me who belong to these groups or who work for these groups and say they're really, really against the killing. And I think push has come to shove now, to be honest with you. I think it's really important now that people speak their minds and just come out and say how they feel. And once again, not saying no is really equivalent to saying yes.
I can't help feeling a certain parallel between this situation and our national politics with the conflict that erupted in Charlottesville over the weekend and the failure of certain authority figures to make a statement against it. And then eventually certain CEOs on an advisory group removed themselves because they wanted no part of what was going on and the lack of the authority figure taking a stand against it. It's an interesting synchronicity in my mind.
It's so interesting that you said that, because I was watching the news this morning. I can usually tolerate it for about 60 seconds. And that's exactly the segment I saw, and that's incredible. Maybe it's not so incredible, but that's exactly my take, was bravo to, for example, the head of Merck Drugs was one of the ones, and of course he got blasted in a tweet later on. But that's exactly my feeling, that at some point people just have to say, I don't want to be part of whatever it is they don't want to be part of. Okay, maybe that's the best way to put it. So, yeah, and I think we're asking, you know, and I know I've been working with Brooks a lot, and we just want to see people come out and say, stop the killing, we don't support it. And it's clear that the excuse that was offered last year, that killing in 2016 would stop future killings, has not worked. And it's not going to work. So, you know, let's stop fooling ourselves.
Well, this very short video, I think it's 26 minutes long, does an amazing job of laying out what's at stake and why killing wolves is counterproductive. Let me just give you a few statistics that come out of this film, The Profanity Peak Pack, Set Up and Sold Out, put out by PredatorDefense.org. In the state of Washington, there are more than 1 million cattle and fewer than 90 wolves. But the cattle take priority over native species. They actually displace deer, antelope, and elk because when they go in and graze, the wildlife, the herbivores, avoid that area. So it's not just the interaction of the wolves and the cattle, but it's also the native species. And what's at stake here? They set it out in 4 points. A rancher set his cattle up for attack by wolves. He actually placed salt blocks within 200 yards of the wolves' dens. The Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife ignored the science, prioritized livestock over wildlife, and failed to require the rancher to protect his cattle. He did nothing to protect his cattle. He just let them loose in this very mountainous terrain that you wouldn't think of as grazing for cattle. Wildlife groups bought into the myth that wildlife must be quote-unquote managed, which the science doesn't say that. The science says that predators are self-managing. And then the final one is that the wolves denied the right to live in peace on wild public land. Do you want to take it from there, Professor Beck?
No, you've really capsuled it perfectly, Joy. I mean, that's exactly what's happening. That's why I said before that, you know, people quibble about the details, and I can understand that sometimes in these situations it's hard to get all the details. But the fact remains that indeed there are cows on public lands. Indeed, these wolves are living on public lands where cows have been put out, and indeed wolves are predators. And I actually don't even mean that jokingly. So that's why I said before that it's like this situation where you get your meal delivered to you at a hotel, room service. You've got all these debates going, and the details are sometimes very hard to reconcile. But the fact of the matter is, killing the wolves also will not work. What I'm really happy about, of course, is that there's people in groups working on all the issues. Using public lands for grazing, for example, protecting cows and killing wolves. Last year I wrote an essay calling Defenders of Wildlife is really Defenders of Livestock. And once again, because they haven't just come out and said stop the killing. So I think, you know, you've got all the details there. And unfortunately, these sorts of conflicts are not going to they're not going to disappear. And I think what's really important is that science very clearly shows that killing wolves and other predators doesn't work. Killing the profanity pack peak of 6 members last year did not stop predation by some animals in the smack owl pack. And why should it? And so, I don't know. I'm not quite sure where to go with it. My take is that the killing has to stop. I mean, that's my take on just a lot of animal protection issues, that the killing has to stop, and we need to find humane, non-lethal solutions to these inevitable conflicts. They're not going to go away. They are not going to go away. There's too many humans. There's limited resources. And if we just keep the killing going, number one, it's egregious, and number two, it won't solve the problems at hand.
And not even considering the ethics and morality of, you know, conservation and wildlife protection and all those things, just a look at the economics of this is kind of shocking.
Yeah.
It cost $135,000 for just the field ops to kill those.
Yes.
That's not including administrative or non-field costs.
Yep.
And the farmer in question who put his cattle in the national forest paid $1.69 per month per cow.
Mm-hmm.
In the meantime, he uses his arable land to produce alfalfa instead of grazing the cattle on his land. And perhaps most shocking of all, since 2011, more or less 5,000 wolves have been killed by hunters and trappers in 6 states. And that's not including the wolves killed by agencies, ranchers, or poachers. And that's as of July 2017.
Yeah.
So there are some people who feel that this is a welfare program for ranchers. If you have any comments on that, I would welcome them.
You know, the only comment I have is pay attention to the data. And I really mean that. I mean, I'm a scientist. I like data. If somebody shows me a graph, you know, where you have an X and a Y axis, and for every increment of increase of one in X, you have an increase in Y of one, then you've got something really happening. And you just laid out the data. If people graphed those numbers you just gave, it would be scary. And the thing is, people don't realize how much, if you will, you know, if you want to put the ethics aside for a moment and look at the economics, how much money is spent to kill one wolf. I mean, when I tell friends that, it blows their minds.
And it's a very brutal process for the most part. Another film that's available by PredatorDefense.org is Exposed, the USDA's Secret War on Wildlife. And it's not just wildlife involved. Pets are being tortured. Humans are being exposed. Since we just brought up the USDA, that's the U.S. Department of Agriculture, I would love your comments on Mr. Sam Clovis, who is Donald Trump's pick to be chief scientist for the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Do you have any comments on his choice?
I don't. I could be kind of flip about it and say, well, if it's someone whose policies he likes, I'm sure I won't. The trend has been to sort of just get rid of the EPA, get rid of all safeguards for the environment. Not too long ago, data from the Animal Welfare Center and data on animal welfare disappeared from public records, and I understand some has come back. My only take on it is that likely he's not someone who's pro-animal or pro-environment, although when you talk about people being pro-animal or pro-environment, you know, there's a wide range of attitudes on it. But judging from listening to your questions and, you know, I know my take on it, he and I would not agree on issues at hand.
Well, I will just quote from an article from ProPublica. Headline, Trump's expected pick for top USDA scientist is not a scientist. Under the 2008 Farm Bill, its leader is supposed to serve as the agency's chief scientist and be chosen, quote, from among distinguished scientists with specialized or significant experience in agricultural research, education, and economics. That's and, not end of quote. But Mr. Clovis appears to have no such credentials. He has never taken a graduate course in science, is openly skeptical of climate change. And while he was a tenured professor of business and public policy at Morningside College for 10 years, he has published almost no academic work. Let's spend the rest of the time that we have talking about your work, Rewilding Our Hearts. First of all, what do you mean by rewilding?
In a personal way, I mean simply reconnecting and becoming re-enchanted with nature and other animals. I mean, that's what I mean by rewilding. And I use the word rewilding because we're born with these natural instincts to like, or in some cases, love nature and other animals. It's called biophilia. And schools, busyness, where people live, alienate them from other nature, so we become unwilded. So I kind of look at rewilding as undoing the unwilding and reconnecting with other nature. And in my book, Rewilding Our Hearts, I really mean it in a heartfelt way, that we really become attached to nature, that we can feel it in our hearts, we can feel it in our bodies, and there's every bit of evidence and data from scientific studies that, in fact, we do. That being out in nature can have a profound physiological and then, say, behavioral or attitudinal or emotional effect on us. So that's what I basically mean by rewilding.
In your book, Rewilding Our Hearts, Building Pathways of Compassion and Coexistence, you go into many elements of what rewilding our hearts mean. But I was taken by an article that was published in the Huffington Post, Inmates, Animals, and Art, Creative Expressions of Compassion and Hope. Mm-hmm. Would you talk about your work at the Boulder County Jail with inmates, art, and animals?
I've been teaching this course for about 17 years now at the Boulder County Jail. You know, the basis is animal behavior, conservation biology, and I go once a week. They write essays. We watch documentaries. They do wonderful artwork, as you saw. I've had a couple of pieces that I've submitted win awards at art fairs. And in a sense, it's a rewilding experience for these guys, some of whom have been in jails and prisons for, you know, really upwards of 25 or 30 years. They are completely alienated from society as well as nature and other animals. And I try to give them hope. It's in the transitions program, which means that they're at a position now where many of them are transitioning out of the corrections institutes, if you will. Some are transitioning in with for rather long sentences. So I'm just trying to have them reconnect with nature, reconnect with other animals. But the important part of this program, too, is that what they learn about reconnecting with nature and other animals also spills over into reconnecting with humans, because they're going to be out on the streets. They're going to be members of society, and they're going to need to become incorporated into the communities wherever they live. And one of the main messages is that the natural tendency of most animals is to be cooperative and kind. I immediately will say this doesn't mean that animals don't fight with one another, harm one another, on occasion kill one another, and I don't mean predators and prey. But the general rule of thumb is that animals are pretty nice to other animals, members of wolf packs. I mean, yes, they fight, but once again, if people look at the data, you know, they'll find that for most of the species who have been studied, individuals display positive or pro-social behavior upwards of 90% of the time. So that's really the basis of the course. It's to teach them some skills, to teach them biology. I mean, it's amazing how much some of these guys learn about ecology and evolutionary biology. And it's amazing the stories they have of their interactions with other animals, because in some cases, other animals were their only friends when they grew up in very abusive environments.
You include in your book, Rewilding Our Hearts, the research on what is called green play and what a positive effect it has on children with attention deficit disorder.
Being outside it's not a panacea for everyone, because people sometimes make that claim. But my attitude is, if being around other animals, you know, particularly companion animals, or being out in nature and seeing trees and plants and breathing in some good fresh air, seeing birds and dogs, for example, or other animals, makes you feel good, then go do it. There are studies that show that animals have very beneficial effects, but nothing is perfect across the board. So, for example, my mother, who was bitten by a dog when she was young, or attacked by a dog, I don't remember the real details, did not like dogs. She didn't hate them. She was afraid of them. So for her, being around a dog or another animal was not particularly comforting. But for many people, it is. So this rewilding can come from just standing out on your porch, if you will, wherever you live. I had a wonderful email from a woman in Chicago who put some plants on the roof of her apartment, and over the course of time, she became the local bird and bee expert. And she was so happy. People would come and ask her questions and stuff like that. That's a personal rewilding experience.
that's kind of intuitive, I think, for many of our listeners, that for many people, being outside, and particularly for children, is beneficial. But you have written a couple of very disturbing articles about what is happening in New Zealand. One in particular, New Zealand imprinting kids for violence towards animals using well-known psychological principles. Would you please inform our listeners about what's happening in New Zealand?
New Zealand, the country itself, has, it's called predator-free 2050. They want to rid the country of invasive predators by the year 2050, which, by the way, isn't that far off. And they're incorporating children. They're teaching children to drown possums, for example, to kill them and dress them up or parade around with the corpses. I mean, this is a fact. People can read my articles on Psych Today or Huffington Post. And the principle is imprinting. There's this phenomenon called the link, which draws a very close connection between violence to non-human animals and violence to humans. And it turns out, and I was absolutely shocked by this, that New Zealand a few years ago had the highest rates of domestic violence in the world, and now they still rank up there. The point I was trying to make is teaching kids to harm, in some cases brutally harm and kill other animals, could have long-term effects in terms of their attitudes towards people. And so it's a fact. I mean, once again, that this is what's happening in New Zealand. It's not some myth. You can go online and just look up the phrase predator-free New Zealand, and you'll come to numerous websites. And the other side of it, Joy, is that they're not using humane methods. They want to use the poison 1080, which is horrific. They'll be trapping, snaring, shooting. So it's a legitimate war on wildlife.
In addition to all the things you've mentioned, I am perplexed. Predators are crucial for ecosystems. So do you have any sense of how they are thinking just in terms of the ecology?
They're not. There's a lot of scientists down there that have told them once again that, you know, ecosystems evolve with the animals who are there. And if you think that you're going to just get rid of all predators or all prey for that matter, or all animals of a, or, you know, all individuals of a particular species, and things are going to be fine, they're not. So once again, it's like the killing of the wolves, it's the killing of predators in Western United States. The science does not support the killing, but they go on with it anyway.
And then finally, this will have to be our last topic. You have written about why men trophy hunt. And I just want to add, in addition to the predators that we have been speaking of, the bison who wander off of national parks such as Yellowstone, they are being hunted as well. So it's not only predators. And of course, we've talked about the delisting of the Yellowstone grizzlies. So if any of them wander off, they will be trophy hunted, managed by the individual states contiguous to Yellowstone National Park. But you have written about why men trophy hunt, and it's not only men, right?
Oh, no, no, no. It's not only men at all. I mean, it may be predominantly men, but, you know, there's a case that I just read about a couple of weeks ago, and I don't know the details and I don't remember the woman's name, but, and it's a sad case where I think a woman trophy hunter killed herself because of all the negative stuff that had come in, you know, on social media and other avenues, I suppose. So no. There's some women parading around. I know that there's a wildlife organization, an environmental organization that has, and I'd like to use the past tense, had an avowed trophy hunter on their board, which actually, Joy, blew my mind, and I got really upset about it because, you know, I call trophy hunting, trophy killing, trophy murder. There's no reason for anybody to go out and kill these animals. None. There's no conservation benefit. It just costs a lot of money, and people make a lot of money from it. It's actually an activity I don't understand, but my take on it, and it's a sad take, is that there just seem to be people who like killing animals.
We should explain, trophy hunting is different from hunting for food. Trophy hunting is hunting basically for a photo op, right?
Yes. Yes, or well, it could be a it could be a photo op, or it could be to hang some head on your wall, right? Or
right,
make a rug
right.
or a jacket or something. Yeah, trophy hunting is not. You know, some people look at it as non-subsistence hunting. You know, you're not hunting these animals because you need the food. You're hunting them as a trophy. It's like a trophy home. It's like a trophy for winning a race. In this case, it's the carcass or the head of an animal.
Well, we are out of time. I want to give you a minute for any closing statements you want to give to our listeners.
Well, thanks. I mean, I enjoyed doing this interview. I think the bottom line is, you know, we've talked about wolves in the West. We've talked about bison. We've talked about what's happening in New Zealand. In our new book called The Animal's Agenda, Jessica Pierce and I clearly lay out, it's written for a popular audience, a broad audience, that things are not getting better for other animals. We make little strides, but, you know, more animals are used in research. The killing of wolves continues. New Zealand's going to have a predator-free campaign. I just learned a few weeks ago that in Australia, they're going to use Judas animals. These are animals who are used to lure in other animals to kill, I think it's feral horses. So things are not getting better. On the other hand, I'm an avowed optimist, and all I could say is to you and your audience that non-human animals need all the help they can get, and if you can do something, then in some cases I see you're obliged to do it.
Well, thank you very much, Professor Mark Beckhoff, for joining us today on Forthright Radio.
You bet. Thank you, Joy, and have a wonderful day. And your listeners can find me at markbeckhoff.com.